So welcome to the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group sponsored panel. My name is Albert Lin. I am the chair of the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. I'm also, in my day job, I am the chair of the appellate practice at Hunt and Andrews Kurth. If you don't know what practice groups are, there are 15 national practice groups, and we're organized by sort of subject matter. And we there's an executive committee that meets and discusses and plans things like this, panels, teleforum, webinars, et cetera. If you are interested in being involved, please reach out to me. So I have the very great honor of introducing the moderator for today's panel, and that's Judge Jim Ho of the Fifth Circuit. Judge Ho. Judge Ho has been on the Fifth Circuit since January of 2018. He was nominated by President Trump. And he's got too many accolades and previous important jobs to mention, but one that definitely has to be mentioned is he was the fourth Solicitor General of Texas. And then he has also served, in addition to his current job, he served in all three branches of the federal government. He clerked for Judge Smith on the Fifth Circuit and clerked for Justice Clarence Thomas. He worked in the Department of Justice and among other places in the Office of Legal Counsel. And he served as chief counsel of a subcommittee on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Judge Ho went to Stanford for his undergraduate degree. This is important. I'll tell you why in a minute. And he got his law degree at the University of Chicago. Perhaps most important, he's a dear friend, and rumor has it that he did not go to Harvard because he got a low personality score. And with that, please welcome Judge Ho.
Thank you, Albert, for that unique warm-up. I'm afraid to prove that low score correctly, but oh well. I'm very honored to be here with you all today, and especially to moderate our panel of the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. I do want to start by noting that the Federal Society recognizes its 40th year anniversary. It was founded back in 1982. That, if I may make a personal note, that also happens to be the year that I became a naturalized United States citizen. And I mention this. Thank you. I mention these two facts because, to my mind, I've always seen the Federalist Society as essentially a celebration of our nation's founding principles, principles that have motivated so many people all around the world to want to come to our shores. When most people think about freedom, they think of the Bill of Rights. But constitutional rights are nothing without constitutional structure. That's something that, of course, members of the society, and especially members of this practice group, don't need any reminding of. But I do think it's a point worth reaffirming every chance we get. I had the honor of serving on the executive committee of the group during my first 5 years out of law school, so I'm especially honored to be moderating today. Our panel today requires our panelists to confront, to reconcile, a number of tensions. I'm very interested to hear what they say about administrative agencies that write countless rules that govern the conduct of private citizens in light of the fact that the Constitution vests the legislative power in the Congress. I'm interested to hear them address the fact that agency officials enforce the law against private parties, even though many of them are not removable at the pleasure of the president, where the Constitution, of course, vests the executive power. And I'm interested in hearing about agency officials who claim the authority to interpret statutes and regulations in a manner that demand deference over the competing views of private citizens, considering that the Constitution vests the judicial power in Article III judges. These are, I think, many of the important tensions in our jurisprudence that dominate so many areas of American society. And with great fortune, we have an all-star panel to help us figure out these interesting issues. We'll begin with Nicholas Perillo, who's the William K. Townsend Professor of Law, as well as the Professor of History at the Yale Law School. He will give us an overview of recent actions at the Supreme Court in this area. Next is Aditya Bhamsai, the Martha Lubin Karsh and Bruce A. Karsh Bicentennial Professor of Law at the University of Virginia Law School. He will discuss the issues of delegation of authority and the separation of powers with a particular focus on the role of federalism under our system. Next, we're honored to have Tom Griffith, who is special counsel at Hutton Andrews Kurth and a former judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, as well as co-author of a recent book about the most recent election. He will be here to argue that the Supreme Court's, if you might call it a skepticism of administrative agencies, he will make the point that that is, in his view, a well-founded skepticism and should continue. I'm excited to say that we will have what I hope to be a powerful response and a good, robust debate from Sally Katzen, who is professor of practice and distinguished scholar in residence, as well as co-director of the Legislative and Regulatory Process Clinic at the New York University School of Law. As I said, she'll offer rebuttal and argue that the Supreme Court's recent trends are flatly incompatible with modern realities of American governance. So with that, I will hand over the microphone to Professor Perillo.
Thank you very much, Judge, and thank you to the Federalist Society for the opportunity to be here today. So I'll talk about how the Supreme Court is reforming its approach to executive power, particularly the president's power to remove officers, and legislative power, that is, limits on congressional delegation to agencies, and relatedly, the major questions doctrine. Now, these two lines of cases differ from each other in that the executive power jurisprudence is tending toward bright line rules, while the legislative power jurisprudence is not. Bright line rules have advantages, especially when doctrine is shifting. They reduce uncertainty for lower courts. They make things predictable for the political branches and for regulated parties. And such rules help the judiciary credibly commit to uniform treatment of disputes, no matter whose ox is being gored. Okay, so starting with executive power, the purest theory adopted by Justices Thomas and Gorsuch is that any officer nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, which would include every principal officer who's right below the president, must be removable by the president at will. And that theory is a bright line rule. Now, of course, this theory has not been fully adopted by the Supreme Court, which has instead inched toward the theory in an incremental way. But the court's incremental holdings are themselves bright line rules as far as they go. In Saleh Law and Collins v. Yellen, the court holds that Congress can protect principal officers against removal, but only if the officers are part of multi-member commissions. In Free Enterprise Fund a few years ago, the court holds that officers can't have tenure protection if they are subordinate to other officers who do have it. Okay, that's executive power. But in the cases on legislative power, we find that bright line rules are much harder to come by. Let's start with the major questions doctrine, which says that if an agency claims some power under its enabling statute, then the majorness of the power counsels against upholding the agency's action. Now, some version of that idea goes back to the 1990s at least. But until this year, the majorness of an agency's asserted power was considered just one factor within a comprehensive analysis of the statute's text and structure. This year, however, The court has begun saying that when an agency asserts a power that is major, a whole different approach to statutory interpretation kicks in, a narrower and more truncated approach with a presumption against the agency. The court simply asks, can the agency point to a clear statutory authorization for this power? If it cannot, the government loses. Strengthened in this way, the doctrine seems like it could have sweeping consequences, but nobody knows because it's not a bright line rule. For one thing, it's hard to know what is a clear authorization, and it's hard to know which agency assertions of power are major. West Virginia versus EPA from a few months ago defines majorness with an unweighted multi-factor test. The factors include how significant the power is economically or just politically, how different the power is from powers previously asserted, how much the power falls within the agency's expertise, and also post-enactment legislative history, that is, whether Congress declined to enact bills that would have specifically authorized the power. Now, perhaps we could derive a more determinate version of the doctrine by looking to its origin and basis. West Virginia says, passingly, that the doctrine rests partly on separation of powers principles, and Justice Gorsuch writes separately that its purpose is to help enforce the non-delegation doctrine. Now, of course, historically, the non-delegation doctrine has been very weak. A statute is upheld if it has an intelligible principle for the agency to follow, and every statute has passed the test except for the National Industrial Recovery Act in 1935. Gorsuch had argued for a tougher version of the non-delegation doctrine back in his dissent in Gundy in 2019, which was joined by the Chief and by Justice Thomas, and seemed to draw sympathy from Justices Alito and Kavanaugh. Gorsuch's version of non-delegation would block agency rules governing private conduct unless they fell into certain exceptions, like rules turning on fact findings and not policy judgments, or rules that fill up the details rather than decide important subjects or make policy. But these exceptions seem quite indeterminate and malleable, especially the exception for any rule that fills up the details. Indeed, Gorsuch said that something could be highly consequential and yet still be a detail. By what principle can a detail be defined? One is reminded of Justice Scalia's warning that there is no way to make the non-delegation doctrine determinate because it inevitably turns upon a question of degree rather than a point of principle. Scalia believed that the rule of law had to be a law of rules, of relatively bright line rules, and he therefore concluded that enforcing the non-delegation doctrine was largely beyond what the judiciary could legitimately do. Now, some people hear that and say, we've got to have a stronger non-delegation doctrine, even if it means deprioritizing the law of rules and making things up as we go. But others hold out hope that a tougher non-delegation doctrine could be reconciled with the law of rules. Justice Thomas, before Gundy, back in his concurrence in the Amtrak case, argued for a version of the non-delegation doctrine along those lines. He said all agency rulemaking governing private conduct, at least domestically, was unconstitutional unless it turned on a factual determination, full stop, with no exception for details. Thomas expressly said this would obviate the need for judgments of degree that Scalia had found so problematic. But really, I doubt that even this formulation would offer much determinacy. The exception for factual judgments is supported by original meaning and by very old precedent. Yet those historical sources show that the exception is broad and difficult to cabin. In Field v. Clark in 1892, the Supreme Court upheld as a fact determination a delegation to the president to activate retaliatory tariffs against any country whose overall tariff policy the president deemed, quote, reciprocally unequal and unreasonable, with no definition of those terms. Congress in the 1790s authorized administrators to set taxable values of land across entire geographic regions at any level the administrators considered, quote, just and equitable. with no definition of value and no methods for finding it. If a factual determination can entail defining the very thing to be found and the method for finding it, it is hard to say how the category is bounded. Thanks.
Thank you, Professor Bonzon.
Thanks, Judge Ho. Thanks for the introduction. Thanks to the Federal Society for the invitation, and thanks to everyone on the panel for what I'm sure will be a great conversation. So Professor Perillo has already set the stage for our discussion of the court's doctrinal approach in these areas. And I understand that Judge Griffith and Professor Katzen will be addressing aspects of the same topic. So I plan to address this topic from a slightly different perspective, namely the history of the Constitution's adoption. It's based on an article that I've recently written, published in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, which I've titled Alexander Hamilton, the Non-Delegation Doctrine and the Creation of the United States. In a nutshell, the debates that led to the Constitution's adoption were in no small part debates about the separation of powers, the precise same issues that the court is grappling with in our current era. When John Jay wrote George Washington in January 1787 to outline a series of wholesale rather than retail changes to the Articles of Confederation that he believed were necessary for the federal government's proper functioning, he placed at the top of the list a proposal to, quote, divide the sovereignty into its proper departments. Jay put it this way, quote, let Congress legislate, let others execute, let others judge. Let me illustrate with one of the most significant political disputes in the decades, years, and even months before the Constitution's adoption, the fight over whether states could delegate authority to the federal government to implement an impost or a tax on imports and exports within states. As many of you may know, one of the most significant criticisms lodged against the Articles of Confederation in the years before the ratification of the Constitution was that the Continental Congress could not directly raise funding for the national government. During the American Revolution, Congress had sought authority to levy a 5% tax on imports, but through a series of twists and turns over years, states objected to giving Congress such authority. In 1783, Congress modified the request to allow states to appoint tax collectors for the impost, though it retained federal authority to remove those collectors, and there's that issue of removal that Professor Perillo just spoke about and highlighted. This was a central dispute of the 1780s, so central that when James Madison spelled out the flaws of the Articles in 1787, he placed the inability of Congress to raise revenue at the very top of the list. And when the state of New York ultimately rejected the impost delegation in 1787, it was not just the death knell of the impost proposal, but effectively the death knell of the Articles. Now, how's this relevant to some of the themes that Professor Perillo highlighted? Well, the impost controversy was actually the occasion for a lengthy and substantial debate over the non-delegation doctrine. Not the non-delegation doctrine under the Constitution's Article I vesting provision, vesting legislative powers in Congress. That provision had yet to be drafted. No, I mean the non-delegation doctrine under state constitutional provisions. Let me focus on New York. There, critics of the proposals for federal imposed authority invoked the legislative vesting clause of the New York Constitution of 1777, which had been drafted, by the way, in part by John Jay and Governor Morris, some high-profile drafters. And contended that it prohibited a conferral of such authority on the federal government. That clause, just so you know, said that the supreme legislative power within the state shall be vested in the legislature. The critics of the impost proposal argued that delegating impost collection authority to Congress violated this provision. And I'll just give you one example. As early as 1783, Abram Yates, who was later a prominent anti-federalist opponent of the Constitution, claimed that the New York legislature lacked the power of, quote, delegating the authority constitutionally vested in them to the federal government. He contended that if the legislature could do so, quote, in this instance, they might in another and at last surrender the whole legislative power. And in later years, this theme was repeated by others, so the same basic point was made not just by Yates, but by other opponents of the impost. Almost 6 years of debate over the non-delegation doctrine culminated in a speech before the New York Assembly by Alexander Hamilton in February 1787. In his speech, Hamilton directly addressed the doctrine at length. He noted that some had charged the Impost Bill with violating this constitutional prohibition on delegating legislative power from New York to Congress. And he characterized this objection as the one, quote, supposed to have the greatest force. He acknowledged the critics' premise that the New York Constitution incorporated a non-delegation principle. He said that, and this is a quote, in the distribution of the different parts of the sovereignty in the particular government of this state, the legislative authority shall reside in the legislature. But relying on other parts of the New York Constitution, Hamilton claimed that a delegation to the federal government did not violate this prohibition against delegations within the different departments of the New York government. So despite Hamilton's speech, which reportedly went on for over an hour and 20 minutes, I'm gonna try and be 20 minutes shorter than that if that's okay with Judge Ho, the New York Assembly voted down the delegation at issue. So Hamilton lost for a moment, and I've just conveyed this episode because it shows that in one of the most consequential debates during the years preceding the Constitution's adoption, legislators within New York repeatedly made arguments based on the premise that the New York Constitution contained a non-delegation doctrine, and that in seeking to rebut that argument, Hamilton accepted the existence of the doctrine, but disputed its application to a delegation to the federal government. There's more to the story. Literally 2 days after Hamilton's speech on the Impost, on February 17, 1787, the New York Assembly adopts a resolution to instruct the state's delegates in Congress to recommend the holding of a convention to revise the articles. On February 21st, so that's less than a week after the speech, Congress sanctions the idea of a convention, and then we all know the rest of the story, against all odds, at the New York Convention in Poughkeepsie in June and July of 1788, the Federalists led by Hamilton and Jay prevail in persuading their fellow New Yorkers to ratify the Constitution. There's much more to be said, particularly about how the ideas of the separation of powers were again implicated during the consideration of the Constitution. But I'll stop right there and allow my co-panelists to say their piece as well. I hope I've given you a sense, through the wind of one high-profile episode, how the separation of powers played a central role in the drafting, consideration, and the writing of the Constitution.
Great. I can't tell you how what an honor it is to be here with this panel and with my friend Judge Ho, and with all of you. If I can be allowed a personal observation, I'm an old man these days, and I wasn't there in the weekend that the Federalist Society was created back in 1982, but I got involved shortly thereafter, and it really is remarkable to me. To see what Leonard and Jean and others have done to literally transform the landscape of American law, it inspires me, and I'm grateful to be part of this and be here today. So, the modern administrative state creates all sorts of tensions, doesn't it? And it has put the separation of powers to the test, right? Separation of powers seemed to be kind of a dry topic before the creation of the modern administrative state. And the description of this panel, what we're to talk about, we're supposed to address a question that I've translated into a more colloquial question. Do we favor the project of the Roberts Court to establish guardrails that keep the executive, legislative, and judicial powers in their own lanes? And I'm here to say, yes, I do. But I'm also here to say that it's probably going to be it's a more difficult task than many in this room might imagine. Let me start with a story, if that's okay. It comes from my first year on the D.C. Circuit. I was on a panel with Doug Ginsburg, who was then our chief judge, and Judy Rogers. And the case was a case that some of you are familiar with. I don't see Professor Epstein here. I've been his whipping boy for 20 years or so on this case. It's the Abigail Alliance case. Very sympathetic group of plaintiffs, children, leukemia patients, who challenged the FDA's a process for approving drugs, right? They said that they thought they had a constitutional right to get to experimental drugs that had been proven safe but not yet effective. That was the issue. I dissented from Judge Rogers and Judge Ginsburg, who said there was a constitutional right to such access. And then it went en banc. Okay, so that's the background. Here's the en banc argument. As best I can recall, I haven't actually gone back to check the transcript because I like my version of the story. And so, but as I recall, Chief Judge Ginsburg is engaged in a colloquy with lawyers for the government. And I can't remember what it was that Doug said that triggered this response, but the lawyer for the government said, "But Chief Judge Ginsburg, the premise of that question, the premise of your comment calls into question the entire structure of the modern administrative state." Hold on. To which Chief Judge Ginsburg said, "So much to do, so little time to do it." So that's what I'd like to use Doug Ginsburg's question as a sort of a framing device. I think that Roberts Court agrees with the first part of it, so much to do. The debate is over the second part of it, how to go about doing it. If I can be allowed another personal observation of my views on the matter, they've transformed over time. In a previous life, I was the chief lawyer for the United States Senate. It was a nonpartisan position, and I defended the Senate and its actions in court. My predecessor as Senate legal counsel had argued in favor of the legislative veto in Chadha. And so I was schooled in the thought that Justice White's dissent in Chadha was right. It was pragmatic. It understood the spirit of the separation of powers. You know, we can play with the forms. I hope I'm doing justice to Justice White. We can play with the forms a little bit as long as we get the spirit of it. And that seemed right to me. I defended the line item veto in briefing and helped prepare the SG for it. Once again, thinking, you know, the forms, they're there, but you can't let them get in the way of the spirit of the spirit of the thing. Well, I have completely changed my view on that over the years. And I completely agree with what Justice Scalia writes. He didn't always stick with this because it's a tough issue. But no, the forms matter. So as I've gotten older, maybe I've just gotten crankier, I'm more of a formalist for the following reason. I have come to distrust ingenuity and imagination and tinkering. The guardrails are important to keep constitutional players in their lanes. And you know, when the Federalist Society got started way back in the day, that used to be our rallying cry, particularly as it applied to the judiciary. Stay in your lanes. Well, that's where I am on this. Now let me talk about each of the projects that the Roberts Court has undertaken. As regards the presidency, they want to give the president more power. Of course, the real problem here is with independent agencies. That's the issue. What in the world do you do with independent agencies? And what are we going to do with Humphrey's executor? Right. I mean, that's the great unspoken question. What do we do with Humphrey's executor? Well, I actually have a solution to that, and I will refer you to PHH Corporation versus Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, a decision of the D.C. Circuit decided 2018. There's a remarkable concurrence in there. We can do it. Humphrey's executor should not be a bar to the president having vigorous removal power. Anyway, you see the argument there. I won't bore you with it here. The second thing, how do you get Congress to do its job? This is a tough one, but they're trying to do it, right? It's really tough to get Congress to do its job, and I don't know how. The major questions doctrine is one. I mean, it's a signal to the agencies. It's also a signal to Congress, right? Do your job, right? I'm influenced by Justice Scalia's view on this problem that what we're, you know, the political scientists tell us what we're dealing with is broad delegations of authority by Congress to avoid electoral responsibility. How do you get around that? I don't know. I'm not certain how you get around that. The gerrymander. Primaries, these make compromise difficult. And the heart of the congressional experience needs to be compromised. Small group dynamics do not work in this Congress. They haven't worked for some while where they used to work in previous Congresses. We're part of the. Maybe you're happy with that. Maybe you're happy with it that no compromises are reached and legislation isn't really done. I'm not. One of the reasons it's not happening is you and me, we won't allow them to vote themselves a pay raise, and so they don't live in Washington. I grew up in Washington, the Washington, D.C. area, with the son, went to public schools, went to the sons and daughters of congressmen and senators. It was no big deal. They lived here. They lived here because they could afford to live here. Now they can't. And so you get these strange things like, I remember hearing Senator Chris Coons once saying, the only time, it's a bit of hyperbole, he said, the only time I interact with folks on the other side of the aisle is in the gym and at prayer breakfast. And that's it. We don't see each other. We don't need each other. Remember a couple years ago, the great innovation at the State of the Union was going to be date night? Do you remember that? That date night, they were going to find somebody from the other side of the aisle and sit next to them at the State of the Union. Well, when you're tinkering with those sorts of things, something is unhealthy and something's wrong. So I applaud what the Roberts Court is trying to do to get Congress to legislate and do its job. I think that's a tough one. Last one, judiciary. Trying to get the judiciary to do our job when it comes to interpreting the law. Here we're dealing with Chevron, right? The whole Chevron problem. Let me tell you another personal story about the dynamic involved there. First year on the D.C. Circuit, I was completely overwhelmed. My opinions were late. I was just beside. It was just too big of a job for me, and I was really discouraged. One of my colleagues, sensing this, took me out to lunch, and I said, "How do you do this job?" And he said, "Well, first thing, it's going to take you 5 years before you feel comfortable." That was not comforting to me because I thought, if it takes him 5 years, it's going to take me 20, right? And so, the next thing that he said was, and the other point is, Chevron, defer. So one of the problems with Chevron is it makes judges' jobs a lot easier, right? So there's that dynamic at work. Okay, so that's the problem. It's deeply entrenched. How do we respond to it? How should the Roberts Court respond to it? They're going to go slow. It's not going to be happy to this group. They're going to be incrementalists. They're faint-hearted formalists, right? They're going to particularly the chief. They're not always consistent with this. Noel Canning. How can you be a formalist and agree with Noel Canning? Here, the executive branch and Congress come up with a workaround for a problematic provision in the Constitution, the Recess Appointments Clause, and yet no one batted an eye at doing that. So they're going to be faint-hearted in that way. As Josh Blackman points out this week, the Monday's cert denial in Buffington, from which only Justice Gorsuch denied, may signal the end of the may signal a truce in the war on Chevron. But I think that's where the battle lies. Is will this court be incrementalist in their approach to the modern administrative state, or will they be bolder? Obviously, there are members of the court who want to be bolder. I think the betting money is that it'll be incrementalist because these things are deeply entrenched. It's going to be hard to get each of these branches to do their job, but I think that's the project, and I'm for it.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all for inviting me to join this discussion of a very significant and timely issue. I'm not sure I can live up to Judge Ho's introduction, being the true skunk at the picnic, but I guess I'm supposed to try. I do think that Judge Ho is correct, that I'm going to take my lead from Judge Griffith, who I greatly admire. Nonetheless, we'll come to a different conclusion than he did. I would like to provide my sense of the court's overall approach to the administrative state rather than talking about specific decisions or specific topics such as the non-delegation doctrine, major questions doctrine, president's removal authority, Chevron, whatever. And when I look, excuse me, a frog has taken up residence. And when I look at the big picture over the last several years, I see a Supreme Court majority that is on a mission to dismantle or at least diminish the administrative state, a mission that I believe is regrettably misguided and in any event not sustainable in this day and age. And I have 5 to 7 minutes to do this. So first off, I do want to give kudos to the Federalist Society, not only for 40 years, most impressive, but thanks in large part to the prodigious work of scholars and law students affiliated with FedSoc, there is a more or less robust framework for Supreme Court's current jurisdiction. Now, guardrails are constructed by the Constitution and supported by historical events. We see it in the decisions regarding reproductive rights and gun rights, slightly off topic, but nonetheless, I'm sure familiar to all of you. If it's not explicitly stated in the Constitution, then it has to be well documented in historical practice. And in either case, the current interpretation should faithfully follow the earliest historical accounts, including the Federalist Papers. And this is relevant because the Constitution doesn't mention the administrative state explicitly, although references to officers and departments suggest that the Founding Fathers did not envision the president being home alone. In any event, much ink has been spilled to try to document that the Founding Fathers had a very constricted view of what the executive branch could do in setting policy. To be sure, there's also a substantial amount of excellent work, some done by Nick, that challenges this view. But assuming arguendo that these were the views held by the Founding Fathers, and that this was the precedent for limiting the administrative state in 1789, what should we do with that? 1789 was a good year. Some might say it was a great year, no doubt about it. But I recall that the original effort to create a government in the Articles of Confederation wasn't very successful, and the Constitution was, in effect, a do-over. Does that mean that we still think of the Constitution as having been chiseled in marble for all ages? Whatever. In 1789, the 13 states were holding on for dear life with their fingernails on the edge of the Atlantic seaboard. The country was primarily agrarian, and the decision makers were virtually all white men whose ancestors came from England or Europe. Today, the country reaches from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast and beyond with Alaska and Hawaii. It is the most powerful and dominant country in the world. We retain agrarian roots, but we also have experienced industrial strength, a thriving service economy, and an information economy. And we have welcomed immigrants from around the world and enfranchised diverse people, including women, all to the lasting benefit of this nation. Now, there are undoubtedly other changes that came with time and technology, but the elephant in the room, no pun intended, was the creation and increased prevalence of political parties. This, despite Madison's warning in Federalist 10 about the dangers of factions in a democracy. What would Madison have thought about Senator Mitch McConnell's response when he became the majority leader in 2010 and asked, what did he want to accomplish? Quote, the single most important thing is for President Obama to be a one-term president. That candid statement reflects what partisan politics has done to our government. It is often not about policy differences. There are some, to be sure. But it's about power. Specifically, it's about winning the next election, which started Wednesday. And party loyalty trumps, again, no pun intended, statesmanship or service to this country. So where are we now? The most powerful branch in 1789 cannot today even debate, let alone decide, the pressing questions of the day. Congress is deeply divided, reflecting a deeply divided country. So Congress can name post offices, but it has the hardest time even passing a budget each year to keep the government open. And while it can spend money and lower taxes through reconciliation, it can do very little of a substantive nature to address the pressing problems that confront this nation. And this is because, in large part, party line votes are the order of the day and too often reflect the calculation of party leaders about how to position the party to prevail in the next cycle. This is the institution that the Supreme Court majority says is the only institution to make laws, to anticipate technological, scientific, or engineering breakthroughs or calamities, and give its blessing in advance to specific solutions it may know nothing about and cannot foresee. That's a lot to ask from an institution that's barely functional. Then there's the executive. In 1789, it was quite fragile. So it was a single person rather than divided, like Congress. It had limited authority and expectations. No wonder it needed support or protection, and you can well understand the decision of 1789, providing the president the power to dismiss at will those who were his closest advisors and confidants. Today, by contrast, the president is undoubtedly the most powerful man in this country, perhaps even in the world. He is accountable. In fact, he gets the credit and the blame for everything that happens, even when he cannot control it, from the spread of the pandemic to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, even to the economy. Yet the court is seemingly concerned that the person with all of this power would be helpless unless he can fire at will anyone who has even a modicum of authority and creativity. I'm thinking of Justice Thomas's concurring opinion in Lucia, defining an officer as anyone who performs a continuous public duty, even if they performed only ministerial statutory duties, including record keeping, clerks, and tide waiters. It was a great profession. We don't seem to have many of them now, but in its time, it was good. And the Chief Justice created, seemingly out of whole cloth, a bright line test that dual for cause removal protection awarded by Congress for a particular category of administrators was too much for the president to bear. So the most powerful person on the planet is somehow too constrained in this day and age unless he can remove an administrative law judge and an independent regulatory commission, a point that Judge Griffith mentioned, or maybe be able to remove a civil servant who has contributed to the development, interpretation, or advocacy of any policy. You might remember Schedule F that was floated towards the end of the Trump administration. All of this notwithstanding the explicit, you want clear language? Explicit terms of the Administrative Procedure Act that protects ALJs and the Civil Service Reform Acts that protect the civil service. Are those acts of Congress, which have been in the books for decades, are they unconstitutional? Are we being directed to return to the days of Andrew Jackson and the spoils system, where loyalty and campaign contributions take precedence over expertise and experience? Oh, it's part of our history. Shouldn't we celebrate our history? Can we do something different than we did in our early days? Or should we actually just return to 1789, where the administrative state is put in a little cubbyhole and we're somehow liberated to be governed only by the institutions as they were then conceptualized? I hope not, because I believe we need, and our founding fathers wanted us to have, I want to repeat that, the Constitution reflects the do-over from the Articles of Confederation, which failed. The founding fathers wanted a government that would work, that would actually function. In that light, I find the 21st century disdain for the administrative state and the multiple efforts of the Supreme Court majority to constrain or hobble it very disconcerting and setting us in the wrong direction. Thank you for listening patiently. You're a good audience.
Well,
I was going to say, this has been a wonderful series of presentations. I want to, we're going to have an opportunity for questions from the audience, but before we do that, I want to give each and every panelist an opportunity to respond or address really anything that we've just heard, if anybody would like.
So if I could just respond to the Please. Excellent presentation of Professor Katzen. To me, the issue isn't whether there should be an administrative state, it's whether it should be politically accountable. And I think that's the project that the Roberts Court has undertaken, is to make the administrative state more politically accountable. Now, you know, I'm no historian and I'm not a political scientist, so forgive my desktop history right here. But as I understand it, the idea of the administrative state as it was created in the 30s or so was to move it away from political accountability. It's a Wilsonian dissatisfaction with the Constitution that was created in 1789, and it's born of an idea that the world is too complicated now, that we need to move away from political accountability. I reject that idea. To me, maybe this is too simplistic, but the most fundamental idea, Akhil Amar writes in his book, The Constitution, a Biography, the most fundamental liberty recognizing the Constitution is the liberty of we the people to make the rules by which society is governed, right? That there's political accountability for all actors. I don't think it's a disdain for the modern administrative state. It's a sense that we need these agencies. They do really important work, but at the end of the day, they need to be accountable to folks who get elected, and I see the court's project as trying to make that happen.
I agree completely with your analysis of it, but I do not see the court's decisions as moving to make it politically accountable. It says you can't make policy, you can't make rules, unless your statute, which was enacted, take the NHTSA statute for highway traffic safety, which was 1966, unless it explicitly states you need seatbelts. I mean, maybe they didn't know about seatbelts in 1966. Probably not airbags, but there might be other things mm-hmm. as well. The rules that are being laid down with respect are not rules that say someone should be accountable. It's, no, Congress has to have said it clearly. My God, it's a major questions doctrine. I'm going back to where Nick started. What is that? It's in the eyes of the beholder. The beholder, 5 or 6 members of the Supreme Court, not anything else defines what is a major questions doctrine right now. So I'm not sure, I agree with your analysis, but I don't think that the steps that they're taking are to drive us towards political accountability.
So do you agree with the project, though, that to make the modern administrative state more politically accountable, we just disagree with what that means and how to do that?
Well,
I'll take that.
I'm more back with Chief Justice Roberts' analogy that a Supreme Court justice calls the balls and strikes and doesn't start constructing houses. Although, having watched the World Series, different people call different balls and strikes, and you may have been irritated at some of the umpires' actions. But I don't see them taking on a project as something that is praiseworthy. Mm-hmm. I think in an individual case, with the individual record, they should follow the law. And with due deference to the precedent, I'm not anti-precedent. Yeah, no, really, I'm not. Okay. Honestly.
I'd like to say a word about the potential implications of the paper that Aditya Bhamsai presented. There's a really interesting debate going on right now about original meaning and non-delegation. I mean, we can debate whether originalism is the appropriate method, but if we assume that originalism is the appropriate method, the question then becomes, what originalist support is there for a non-delegation doctrine, or for what kind of non-delegation doctrine? And basically, this debate is occurring at two levels, or in two steps. First, there's a question as to whether there's a non-delegation doctrine, even in principle. Okay, some scholars have argued that there is not, as a matter of original meaning. For example, Nicholas Bagley and Julian Mortensen at the University of Michigan, they argue that as long as a power that's delegated to the executive is authorized by legislation, there is nothing about that power that could violate the legislative vesting clause. There's no amount of discretion that is too much. There's no type of power delegated that is too much, even in principle. However, if we reject that view and we say, oh, no, actually there was some limit in principle, then we get to a second step or a second question in the debate, which is, okay, what do the originalist sources tell us about how to cash that out? Okay, is it a matter of, too much discretion being unconstitutional? Were verbal formulations like important subjects and details used in the founding era, or is there originalist support for a more categorical non-delegation doctrine, like no rulemaking unless it's about fact findings or something like that? I think what Aditya Bhamsai's paper does is it provides some very interesting new evidence going to the first question, going to the question of whether, in principle, there is some limit on delegation. We now have Alexander Hamilton in 1787, shortly before the Constitutional Convention, talking about the New York state constitution, but it's common to use contemporary understanding of state constitutions to look to federal constitutional structure, getting into a debate about whether it violates a New York state non-delegation doctrine for the New York legislature to delegate power to the Continental Congress, okay? And you can say, well, that's irrelevant to the question of whether, the U.S. Congress under our Constitution can delegate power to the executive because, Congress controls the executive in a way that the New York legislature could never control the Continental Congress. But Aditya points out that Hamilton rejects the idea that there's any limit on delegations to the Continental Congress, but then he says, but there would be limits on the New York legislature's delegations to its own executive. Okay, so that is interesting evidence going to the sort of the threshold question of whether there's a limit in principle. But that, as I think Aditya recognizes in his paper, it doesn't tell us about how such a limit ought to be cashed out. And I actually think if we're to have justification for reforming the non-delegation doctrine today, we actually need to answer both of those questions. Not just that there was a non-delegation doctrine in principle in 1787, but that there are some originalist sources about how it's to be cashed out that are different from the non-delegation doctrine we have. And I will remind you that officially, we do have a non-delegation doctrine, Okay, the Supreme Court has not overruled Schechter-Poultry. And there's a very important study recently by Carrie Colonnese arguing that it's not right to say that the non-delegation doctrine is dead. You can still say Schechter-Poultry is rightly decided, but all these other cases where delegations have passed muster are also rightly decided because the National Industrial Recovery Act in 1935 really was different from everything that has come before and after, because not only were there standardless delegations, but those delegations covered the entire economy. There was an authorization under that act to limit output and fix prices for every industry in the economy, which is quite different from giving very open-ended standards for the telecommunications industry or securities offerings or that kind of thing. That said, I do think there is a further implication, potentially, of Aditya's paper, which is that, and Aditya didn't have time to get to this in his presentation, but as he explains in the paper, when Hamilton is describing the legislative power that is subject to a non-delegation doctrine, what is legislative power? He says not only that it includes things that involve coercion as to private persons, like standards for weights and measures in transactions. It also includes, correct me if I'm wrong, the power to make rules for the Army and the Navy, and the power to make requisitions of other governments, intergovernmental relations. And this, it seems to me, goes against a reading of the vesting clause of Article I, propounded by Justice Gorsuch and others, that legislative power was understood in 1787 to be confined to general rules governing private conduct, such that the non-delegation doctrine today would not cover the welfare state, government largesse, benefits, and would not cover the national security state either. Okay, the non-delegation doctrine as proposed in the Gundy dissent is one that would go to the domestic regulatory state, but not the national security state. It seems to me that Hamilton's speech is some evidence against that narrowing view of the doctrine.
Yeah, well, thanks, Professor Perillo, for those comments. Just off the cuff, I think I largely agree with them, potentially when you were starting to discuss Schechter-Poultry and how that could be described as an opinion about the specifics of the National Industrial Recovery Act, I may part ways on that topic, but I think you're quite right that there's a threshold question of whether there was such a principle in the abstract that was articulated, embraced, discussed by key members of the generation that put together the U.S. Constitution. And then there's a second question about how to implement that. Perhaps this connects with the conversation that Judge Griffith and Professor Katzen were having just a moment ago, because I think what we see, or what one would find in founding era materials, like Professor Katzen referenced the decision of 1789, which is the famous debate in Congress about removal and who has that power over the federal bureaucracy, what we would find is the general topics that are being debated to this day at the Supreme Court are the types of topics that were discussed. And so to my mind, and this may go to a broader question, that has some relevance, that sort of suggests what the Constitution was meant to do. And so maybe to that threshold question, I would suggest like the answer that is that there was an inference from legislative vesting provisions that the legislature could not delegate legislative powers, however defined. And I think that Professor Perillo is quite right. And I think this is, a topic for, we could go on for quite some time. How to implement then the abstract principle of a non-delegation doctrine or whatever principle you take away from the decision of 1789, how to implement that once you believe that there is this notional, this principle that there was a non-delegation doctrine. That's something that the court's going to have to grapple with if, in fact, it embraces an originalist approach. And I don't think the paper that I've written quite answers that. And I was very interested to hear Professor Perillo's thoughts on how the paper can cut in different directions on that point. I think more work is necessary, or more research is going to be necessary for us to fully understand, like, how to provide the lines that form, to use Judge Griffith's words, the guardrails that the Roberts Court is setting out. I just don't think that those guardrails are newfangled or newly created. They in fact, have been around for a long time, and perhaps their implementation is going to be based in part on the historical record and in part on our attempts to translate that historical record to modern society and government.
So can I ask a question? So let's imagine we're back before Humphrey's executor, okay? Just we're in that universe. What do you do with the effort of Congress to create independent agencies insulated from the president's removal power? Let's imagine that's where we are. Is that a good step? Is that a step forward? Is that eviscerating something, or is it ingenious tinkering that's right? I think you know where I think. I think it's wrong. But that, to at least in my mind, that's a critical distinction. Where would we be before Humphrey's executor?
Well, Humphrey's executor came very quickly after Myers,
which
praised the power of the executive. But specifically to your question, when we talk about IRCs, independent regulatory commissions, our minds usually go to the SEC or the FTC, which was the animal at issue in Humphrey's executor itself. And then the more recent cases have been SEC cases. I keep thinking about the Fed, the Federal Reserve. That's an independent regulatory commission. And why is it independent? It's independent because you don't want the political people, both the executive or the Congress, screwing around with monetary policy, particularly on the eve of elections. Now, what I think was intended when they set up the IRCs initially was to an inverse of the major questions doctrine, which subjects are so sensitive that we don't want the politicians to be jerking them around right before elections or back and forth and back and forth. We want experts. We want people who are using judgment, science, technology, whatever. And so you had a series of independent regulatory commissions that were subject specific that was just too sensitive, or at least of a different ilk than executive branch agencies. That's what I think is part of the framework.
But I want to get normative about that.
Oh.
Is that consistent with the Constitution? I mean, I agree with you on the Fed. I think it's worked very well. And I don't want a president who's behind in the polls facing, I don't want that either. But I don't want to talk about real world just now. We'll get to that. I want to talk about the formalistic approach. Is that consistent, this ingenious creation of the independent commission, is that consistent with the constitutional structure, or is it in fact an amendment to the Constitution that didn't go through the amendment proceeding process?
You've given me two stark choices, and I don't like either one
of
them.
Okay.
But that's because I tend to think, and I think it was Chief Justice Marshall way back when who said something about creating a constitution. We did the best job we could, and we'll learn from experience as life goes on. Now, is the only manifestation of our learning to be embodied in an amendment through the amendment process? And that's an implication of what you said. Right. And I tend to think that is a very legitimate way of looking at it. It's not my preferred position, because I'm alive today, and there are issues that I would like to to find some compromise on, and we're bound by institutions that seem to have an inability to compromise. And I don't think that's a good place. And I don't think our founding fathers would praise us for maintaining all of their specific implementations of their principles. I think they would rather we continue to be the phenomenally great country that we are because of our ingenuity and our entrepreneurship and our ability to make things work in a real world. So I've slipped into world again. Sorry.
I think the only way we differ on that is I'm more comfortable with the view saying you make that world a better world by playing well the part that's given to you in the Constitution, right? And judiciary, here's your job. Executive, here's your job. Legislature, here's your job. And don't get those jobs confused because the system is built on this. And so I would favor that over the real world ingenuity. And that may cause us serious problems, but I think that's what the Constitution demands. But maybe not.
I understand where you're coming from.
If I may say a word about this. So the president has the executive power and then also the obligation to faithfully execute the laws. And let's say Congress passes a law that states in the text that its objective is to control inflation. So the president is obligated to faithfully carry out that law. And let's say that economic actors out there think that inflation is going to keep increasing. Those expectations feed on one another. And it is basically impossible for the law, that we want to control inflation to be successfully executed unless the president makes some kind of credible commitment to control the money supply. But these economic actors, out there in the markets don't believe that the president will control the money supply because they know that the president, has an interest in not causing a recession and that sort of thing. And they know that the president is beholden to the voters of the next election and so forth. So, I mean, if you're the president under those circumstances, how do you faithfully execute a law that can't be executed given other actors' accurate perceptions of your political incentives? What you might want is for your hands to be tied in a credible way, in a way that audiences and the markets will believe. And it may be that the only practical way for that to happen, the only way for the law to be executed, is for someone else to tie your hands, for Congress to tie your hands. So, I mean, that's some argument for the consistency of some versions of an independent agency with Article 2. It is much more believable, as Sally Katzen suggested, with regard to agencies like the Fed, where there are distinct problems of credible commitment, which may not be as much of an issue with regard to the FTC or the SEC, although we can debate that as well. I mean, that would be a possible response to your question, Judge.
Thank you.
So, just to weigh in with, I think I have perhaps arriving at some similar place, just a slightly different way of analyzing this, which is that there was, in fact, an institution, not on all fours, but somewhat analogous to the Fed, the Bank of the United States, both the first bank and the second bank, that was chartered at the same time that Congress engaged in this debate, conferring the removal authority on the president. And apparently they considered the bank to be consistent with their position in the debate about the removal power. So I think that one could say that the Fed, there's a historical antecedent for some of its authority. And so it's consistent with the court's jurisprudence in this area. But you know, just to add another hypo to people's thinking in this, in this point, it can't just be because we have an institution named the Fed. We could just confer on it any authority and have that be insulated from presidential control. So what if, for example, you know, Congress were to enact a statute saying, oh, the Fed shall also now have supervision over, I don't know, I'll just pick the CIA. You know, they'll also have, they'll also be able to control some aspect of the national security state, or, you know, you could say part of the Department of State, pick whatever agency you'd like. It's not that we have, you know, a carve out for the Federal Reserve. Rather, conceivably, what we could say is that we have a historical antecedent for certain types of government functions that are associated with banking or money creation that, that can be subject to certain mechanisms akin to what we now have for the Fed, but not other types of government functions. That's the way in which the system sort of like holds together. So that's a thought that maybe explains part of what the court is doing in its removal cases and part of where it might potentially go if, in fact, faced with point that Professor Katzen raised.
I think we have at least one question out in the audience, maybe a few more. Let me start by saying, tell us your name, any affiliation you want to reveal, and we are asking you to ask a question.
Thank you. My name is Francis Menton. My affiliation is Manhattan Contrarian. That's my blog. Many people may read it here. So out there, we have the Clean Air Act, and the Clean Air Act basically gives the EPA the authority to regulate pollutants. And then about a decade ago, the EPA decided carbon dioxide was a pollutant. And I guess this question is mainly for Professor Katzen. So carbon dioxide has been declared a pollutant by the EPA, and they're an expert. So does that mean, could the EPA, on its own authority, then say, well, airplanes, they all generate carbon dioxide. We hereby say they must be all grounded. Oh, all industry must be ended. That generates carbon dioxide. And 80% of our electricity is fossil fuel, generates carbon dioxide. And of course, all automobiles, so you can't drive them anymore. Can the EPA do that? Or does that go beyond what they've been authorized to do? And if it goes beyond, what is the limiting principle? Do you have one, or are you completely fine with that if EPA does that?
I'm not, excuse me, I'm not sure I completely followed because there's a lot of distracting noise out there, but the Congress clearly gave the EPA authority to specify those pollutants that are dangerous and should be regulated, and to set limits for them based on that which is necessary to protect the public health with an adequate margin of safety and all that. There are standards to be applied. They can't just say, no cars. I don't think that would survive any kind of judicial review.
Under what's the standard?
Under, excuse me?
What's the standard?
What's the standard?
The standard is set forth in the Clean Air Act is the scientific basis for levels to be set. That's not, I'm not an environmental lawyer, and I'm sure there are others here who could provide the exact terminology. But the EPA is not able to and does not do whatever it has a whim to do when it wakes up in the morning. It bases it normally through rulemaking on notice and comment, cost-benefit analysis, scientific determinations that are subject to the critique and then response by the agency. You may not be happy with the answer any more than I was not happy when they stayed the Clean Power Plan in the first place, even though it had not yet gone through the courts. It was an extreme action taken to shut down rulemaking in this area And I think that was unfortunate that we never were able to develop the kind of record that would enable sensible people to see if the agency was acting within its authority as granted by Congress. I am not saying that the organic statute or the authorizing statute is meaningless. It survives. But if it has granted authority, then the agency should be able to use it, even if the pollutant is something that they didn't think of when they passed the statute or weren't aware of when they passed the statute, any more than under the FCC Act. It was radio. That was in 1933. It was radio. Radio was interpreted to mean television. It wasn't a big step.
Gentleman up front.
Yeah, Brian Bishop of the Stephen Hopkins Center for Civil Rights in Rhode Island. And I have a narrower and perhaps almost pedantic question raised by Nicholas's kind of recitation of what makes up possibly or the factors that could define a major question. In particular, I'm concerned with a different decision that Aditya mentioned of Justice White's, and that would be Riverside Bayview Homes, in which there the judge said that he was chary to effectively say what the law was by what Congress did not do. And I'm afraid he wasn't chary enough myself, but here you're saying that I think a kind of significant factor in that list was whether Congress had tried to give this power and failed. And I personally, as much as I can perhaps see a more convincing argument for the inverse, I still am concerned about that as a standard. I don't know if that is the panel's concern shared.
So to be fair to the author of the West Virginia opinion, if I recall correctly, when the chief starts talking about bills that Congress did not enact, I think he prefaces it by saying, we cannot ignore that these proposals were made in Congress and Congress didn't enact them. So, I mean, the chief himself seems somewhat wary of relying on this kind of material, but he does cite it. And related to what I was saying earlier about, you know, this being kind of an unweighted multi-factor test, it's hard to say how much weight it has in the analysis. I think what Justice Scalia and other statutory interpretation textualists have said for decades about the peril of relying on post-enactment legislative history or, you know, congressional failure to act is absolutely right. I mean, it really is treacherous to make inferences from that kind of lawmaker behavior. My hope would be that the court is not going to rely too much on that going forward.
Gentleman in back.
Hi, Bailey Cordonier, President, Northwestern Student Chapter. Judge Griffith mentioned INS v. Chadha, and I also think of cases like Vermont Yankee that make me wonder a couple of related things. One, does formalism only limit the executive in this area, or can formalism bolster that power? And if that's the case, how does that limit the hopes or concerns of the panel?
Can you repeat it? Just speak up a little louder. Thank you.
Yeah.
If people, when they go out, would make sure that they close the door immediately because there's a lot of noise out there and we can't hear what's being said, unfortunately. Thank you.
I'll let them close the
or
door.
Or just don't leave.
Better yet.
We only have 10 more minutes. Go on.
Yeah. So cases like INS v. Chadha or Vermont Yankee that are more formalist seem to actually increase the power of the executive in this area. So I wonder, is it true that a more formalist approach would simply limit the executive, or can it bolster it and go different ways? And if so, how does that temper either the hopes or the criticisms of the panel?
What would be an example of formalism bolstering I'm not disputing it, but yeah, That'd be helpful to me if you'd give an example.
Yeah, I think like Vermont Yankee, in which said that the court, for example, is limited in adding new requirements to what the administrative agencies or the executive does, That seems to me a very formalist opinion that actually increases the power of the presidency, at least away from the power of the courts.
Yeah, see, I wouldn't worry about that as much because maybe I'm thinking too simply here, but to me, the virtue of formalism is that it is, in effect, playing the role of an umpire and saying, here are the rules, here's what you can do, here's how you do it. Now, what you end up doing, that's up to you, you know? But you gotta play by these rules. These formal rules are imbued with values. The rules themselves express a value about how we think the republic should operate. So I don't think the question, at least in my mind, isn't so much whether the result of formalism is an increased power for the executive or a decreased power. It's that you're staying true to the values that were encoded in the Constitution, built upon which the Constitution was built in creating the separation of powers in the first place. And so I don't know if that is responsive, but that's how I think of your question. Is that helpful or not?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you for saying it was helpful.
So, I think just to answer the question, I think there's no necessary connection between formalism or functionalism and any allocation of powers within the branches or to the executive. And so, you know, one can think of a whole number of cases. You mentioned Vermont Yankee, but the one that comes to mind, for example, is the prosecutorial discretion case, Heckler versus Cheney, where the court says, oh, there's going to be relaxed review in a certain category of cases. So whether that increases or decreases executive power, the point is that it just depends on what the rules are. And you have to start to look at the rules and figure out whether there's some honest justification for why the rules are being created the way that they are.
Gentleman in front.
Hi. Hello. Devin Watkins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And concerning the dysfunctional Congress, I understand that it's not passing the laws you would like, but for me, the choice not to pass law is a proper choice for a Congress. Too often I see agencies create the rules of private conduct that govern citizens. They find the people that violate that, and then they find that they're guilty, and they determine that fact that they're guilty. And to me, placing all three of those in the same hands creates a horrible incentive that really undermines the rule of law. And I understand that enforcing the vesting clauses by judges may be difficult. It may not lend itself to bright line rules, but I don't think we hire judges just to handle the easy cases.
Yeah.
So I would like to hear the panel's opinions on that.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point that I don't disagree with. Gridlock can be really good, right? Yeah, I'm not interested in Congress becoming a juggernaut, just legislating left and right. But can we agree that at some level Congress isn't working the way it should? I mean, when you can't get a budget passed, there's just some basic stuff that needs to happen that isn't happening, and that's my concern. I'm not looking for lots of legislation coming out of any Congress, but I'm looking for some, and there's some serious problems that we are facing as a nation. I used to be Senate Legal Counsel. I'm a Article I sort of guy, you know, and I think that's where these things are supposed to be resolved. They're supposed to be debated and resolved in front of those who are most closely connected to the populace. That's our members of the House, members of the Senate. And I'm coming from a place where I just think it's dysfunctional in ways that are troubling. But I'm not arguing for a juggernaut, but something that, and maybe you disagree with that. Maybe you're satisfied with the stasis. I'm not. I think there's some pressing issues that need to be resolved.
I agree with you completely. Yeah. I'm not looking for Congress to legislate every day and pass thousands and thousands of bills. I am interested in Congress, our elected representatives, discussing, debating the issues of the day so that the American people could be better educated about what is going on and have a better understanding of our society writ large. And I think that that is critically important, that we don't even have to, in the Senate now, there aren't, someone says, I'm going to filibuster. They don't even have to stand. I love Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. They don't have to stand up. They don't have to be exhausted. All they have to say is, I'm going to filibuster. Full stop, no more discussion, on to the next item. One wonders why some of people can't hear each other. They're not speaking the same language. There isn't a place where we can have a dialogue. And we have some members of Congress who have been elected on a platform of, I will not compromise. I will not agree to anything except that which I absolutely believe in. Well, in a country of ours, it's very hard to exist if you can't have a meaningful conversation and some give and take and maybe, dare I say, some compromise. And I'm fully prepared to be voted down. I'm fully prepared to have Congress not take any action. I would like them to talk.
So I'm actually going to exercise the prerogative to ask my own question, because you've both mentioned congressional dysfunction. And like Tom, I too consider myself an Article I guy, having worked there. So let's just take as a given, both of you, saying that there's a lot of dysfunction in Congress, and there are a lot of problems in society. We've talked a lot about horizontal separation of powers. We haven't really talked about vertical separation of powers. If we take the congressional inaction and paralysis as a given, why is the answer executive power as opposed to returning action to the states and having perhaps a vision of the federal government that is more consistent with the founding? Any reactions to that idea? I mean, in other words, would a lot of these separation of powers problems about the administrative state go away if the federal government simply did less?
No, go ahead.
I'm attracted to that idea, except that we have seen in certain areas races to the bottom or other kinds of actions by states that have produced a hodgepodge of rules. And just as you have the California emissions rules, which now govern the country because it's such a large market, and you have one state making that decision, how do the other states feel about that? Even though I, whatever my personal views might be. And similarly, in terms of child labor or minimum wage or other kinds of a taxing policy where states are trying to attract businesses, you have some very strange play in the joints. And for nationwide companies, it drives them crazy. I mean, before I went into the government, before I went into teaching, I was in private practice, and the biggest complaint I got from our clients was, my God, what am I supposed to do? I got 12 different rules I have to follow. And what they wanted was a federal rule preempting state rules. Now, that's only in certain areas, and I'm making a broad statement based on anecdotes. But while I'm attracted to the idea, and that's actually what the Supreme Court has handed us in Roe v. Wade, in the Dobbs case, is every state should decide. And you look at the results on Tuesday, where the five states that had a ballot questions came out in favor of reproductive freedom rather than restrictions on abortions. And I don't think anyone anticipated that particularly. But is that really going to solve some of the issues we have? I don't know. Is it worth trying? Anything is worth trying now. We are in...
Well, I love the enthusiasm of the panelists and of all the questioners. I'm afraid we're out of time, so would you please join me in welcoming and thanking the great professor.